Schitt's Creek is one of those shows a lot of people may have told you to watch. And a lot of you told us to watch it too. Because as always, you're very wise.
The Canadian comedy from the minds of Eugene Levy and his son Daniel follows a wealthy family that falls on hard times. They have no choice but to retreat to the small town they'd once bought as a joke. I'm Stephen Thompson.
And I'm Linda Holmes. We're talking about our listener poll winner, Schitt's Creek, on this episode of Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. Here with me and Stephen, not in the studio, but from under a blanket in his home, is Glenn Weldon of NPR's Arts Desk. Hi, Glenn.
Hey, Linda. I told you so. I told you so. I told you so.
You did, and you must be feeling so incredibly smart. I'm going to get to you in a minute. So before we get started, just to set the stage, if this isn't a show that you know well, the Roses are a wealthy family that falls on hard times. The father and son are played by Eugene Levy and Daniel Levy. The mother is Moira. She's played by Catherine O'Hara. The sister is Alexis. She's played by Annie Murphy. They go to the only place they have left as an asset, which is the town of Schitt's Creek, S-C-H-I-T-T-S, Creek, which Johnny once bought for David as a gag gift. They go and start living in two rooms in the motel in that town. It is a very much a fish out of water story. They meet a bunch of the people who live in the town. Roland Schitt, who's played by Chris Elliott. Stevie, who runs the front desk at the motel. They meet a whole bunch of different people and they have to kind of get adjusted. And that's the basic premise of the show. Stephen, I want to ask you, what'd you think of the show? Did it take you a while to get into it?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I've been hearing about this show from Glenn for several years now. And for Glenn, Glenn has had a lot of time to get acclimated to these characters. And it's been probably a little bit more of a slow burn, you know, relationship. Mm-hmm. For me, mainlining 77 episodes of this show in the span of a few days to prep for this, it was a little bit of a different experience. And I didn't have quite as much of the experience that everybody had told me to expect, which is this show takes a while for you to learn to like these characters. It starts out much more arch and a little bit nasty as this family clearly kind of looks down on the people of Schitt's Creek. And over time, it accumulates more warmth. And I didn't have as much of that issue. I was spotting notes of warmth by the second or third episode. There's actually a little exchange between Eugene Levy and Catherine O'Hara, the wonderful Moira Rose. They have an exchange late in like episode 5 where they're just bantering with each other so lovingly. And I picked up very early on that part of what I was going to love about this show is that this family, they're extremely selfish and they're extremely spoiled, but they're also extremely loving toward each other. And they're capable of real warmth and depth in their relationships that obviously over the course of 6 seasons, this show is really able to tap into in very sweet ways. So ultimately, I loved it very quickly.
Yeah. Glenn, I know you've been a fan of this show for a long time. Why do you think it won the listener poll? What do you think it is that people have hooked into with this show so much?
I think it's because a lot of people out there are smart like me, and we get the show. And we got it from the beginning, even though, you know, I'll push back a little bit, Stephen. Everything about the show at the beginning, from its name and a lot of the key art and a lot of the ads for it, kind of pitched it as this kind of broad, crass sitcom that even though it has Catherine O'Hara in it and Eugene Levy, I couldn't figure out how to approach it. And, you know, I would think that the character Roland Schitt, who was very prominent in the opening season, he is a guy who basically insults Eugene Levy's character a lot. And that it flirted with cringe comedy. It flirted with insult comedy. And, you know, let's face it, this show was never Kimmy Schmidt. It was never 30 Rock. It was never a joke delivery vehicle. The humor was always grounded not just in the relationships, but in the reactions. Mm-hmm. From the moment the show opened, we would get a shot of David reacting to something that his father or his mother were saying by trying to stifle a smile.
Yeah,
this is his characteristic thing now. And Alexis does it as well. Stevie does it a lot as well. What that is it could seem mean because they're kind of making fun of whoever's talking to them. But ultimately, it becomes about how much those characters are relishing the moment, enjoying what they're seeing, what the person is telling them. That adds a layer of, again, not a joke, but the humor, the reason that you love these characters is because of how they react to each other.
Absolutely.
I do think that this show, which is so gentle and Canadian, has developed a fan base which is rabid in a way that doesn't really necessarily jibe with the tone of the show. We went to see a live version where the cast members came out and answered questions and shared stories that they probably have shared a lot on that particular Schitt's Creek tour. But the fan base was going nuts. And I think that has something to do with the fact that it went from being on pop only in the States to Netflix. As soon as that happened, it opened up and a lot more people could see it. But I have some thoughts about why people might be reacting to the David Patrick relationship with the fervor that they are. But we'll get to that later.
All right. We're going to have a fight about that later, Glenn.
Yes, we are.
Since we did this as our listener poll, we wanted to essentially go to some of the questions. We really appreciate all of you guys who left us voice memo questions because we wanted to hear your voices. And so our first question is from Andrew.
Hi, Pop Culture Happy Hour. This is Andrew from Decorah, Iowa calling. I'm wondering what the moments were that humanized the characters for you, the moments that changed them from being caricatures in the beginning to fully fleshed out emotional beings by the end.
Yeah, so in the first couple of seasons, I found the show really funny. I thought the performances were great and fun. I did have a little trouble kind of keying into it as a story. But at the end of the second season, there's an episode where Moira and Johnny go out to dinner. And in the course of a scene, you kind of see, it's not that that is when they shift, but it is when the show kind of fully acknowledges that they have shifted from feeling sorry for themselves all the time about having to be in this town with these people to being really of the town and caring about their neighbors. And at that point, you pretty much see a full end to the stories that revolve around them feeling sorry for themselves. And although I always thought the show was good and enjoyable, it's not as if I think the first two seasons are a drag or anything. Once you get out of them feeling sorry for themselves, I think it opens up considerably. What do you think, Glenn?
Yeah, I mean, it starts off as a fish out of water comedy, of which there have been many, 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 and ultimately kind of abandons that trope because it's not paying off as many dividends as it was in the beginning. I see this as the Moira Rose show, basically, unsurprisingly, because it's Catherine O'Hara. And her character starts out pitched higher than all the other characters are, broader, more a caricature, because the character of Moira Rose is a caricature that she has created for herself. She has created this persona, and she's clinging to it desperately. But what the show smartly does is she lets her be vain and self-involved throughout the show. But very importantly, we come to realize that she is very smart about what she does, about being a star, about not so much acting. She might not be that great at acting, doesn't really matter, but she's great at show business and at making any project she's involved with better. She also gets better at being a mother. She has no interest in it in the beginning, but I've talked about that scene in the episode where Patrick gets up in front of a crowd to serenade David with Simply the Best. Because this show has dabbled in cringe comedy, we think we know exactly where this scene is going. We think it's going to be awful. And then with that moment where Moira reaches out to touch David's shoulder, as if to say, no, this is real. Do not react, because this thing is real, and it kind of gets through both of our facades. The moment where she talks to Stevie in the episode Moira's Nudes, where she says, treasure your beauty because it is fleeting. and also the scene where she finally acknowledges Alexis as somebody who can carry off a speed dating day at the diner, where she just comes to respect her children and the people of this town, even though she remains who she is because Catherine O'Hara is just that great.
Well, I want to push back about thinking of Schitt's Creek as the Moira Rose show, because I really feel like it's the David Rose show. And really,
that's how I feel too.
And really immediately dug into what Daniel Levy was doing with that performance from very early on in the show. You mentioned the stifled smile and how good he is at the stifled smile. This character in particular does more smiling and more the fact that they're kind of laughing at each other's humor and just enjoying each other's company is something that's actually really novel in a lot of these comedies. A lot of these comedies aren't willing to show you characters laughing when things are funny.
Right.
And this show does that so well. He has an amazing eye roll. He has an amazing grin. I love that character so much.
Yeah, and I want to add, there's also, particularly with David, there are a few instances, and this really kind of comes into play with Patrick once he meets Patrick. There are some instances where he's repressing a smile because he's so moved and delighted by something that's happening. That to me is just magical. That is magical when that happens, and I love it so very much. Glenn, what are you thinking?
What Dan Levy has been able to do is allow the character of David to get insight, to become self-aware, but not to change.
Right.
To add layers, but not to abandon who he was in the beginning, but to grow. This is exactly what's happening to him. He's growing.
Glenn, normally you hate growth.
I have some nitpicks about how this character particularly grew in relationship to Patrick. Let's get to it.
Yeah, let's get to it. You are so wrong about this, because okay. I love the David and Patrick relationship. Yeah. It is one of my favorite love stories on television, and you're against it, and it makes me so sad.
What is happening is that Patrick is marrying the first dude he slept with, mm-hmm. which is just so many red flags, more red flags than the Kremlin. That is, it is not healthy. It's not a difference in power. It's a difference in experience, and it is doomed. But because the show is set in a fantasy world that has no homophobia, apparently we're supposed to buy that these two characters are meant for each other. Look, I get it. They're very cute together, and I get that the show doesn't want to kind of really explore gay relationships in the kind of thorny way that they can be. But it took so long for them to start writing Patrick as anything but this character whose entire self was I like David. Finally, in the last two seasons, we've gotten layers. We've gotten layers, and I like that. Flaws, that's important. But I just don't buy these two as a couple, and I know I'm alone.
Okay, first of all, I think they've given us more and more of Patrick's personality as we go along. I also think they're using that actor, Noah Reed, really, really well, taking advantage of his musical chops. That performance of Simply the Best, I think, is just one of my favorite scenes of television in a really, really long time. But I also think the show is not completely blind to that dynamic where this is Patrick's first gay relationship. There's a whole plot line at one point where David is trying to open up their relationship so that Patrick can have other experiences, and they go through trying to figure that out. And I kind of, at the end of that process, they acknowledge at some point that is probably going to have to happen in their relationship. I felt that those discussions were almost uncharacteristically wise and mature for those characters, but I did think they were acknowledged.
The thing that I admire so much about it is that I think it is so hard, that the level of difficulty is so high when you take a character who is as weird as David and you try to create a relationship between him and a person who, and this is kind of an explicit joke early in the time that they know each other, someone who is like aggressively a basic like Patrick. Mm-hmm. But Patrick also turns out to be like very wryly funny. He kind of understands what makes David tick. He understands David's weirdness and understands it as a part of his personality, but not the entirety of his personality. And they've continued to drop in little hints of the fact that David is capable of being very caring and generous to this person. So it's not a matter of like, why would Patrick even like this guy? Mm-hmm. I buy this relationship completely. I'm not in any way, Glenn, questioning your what should gay guys do cred. I'm just saying, I think it's a swoony romantic story, very similar to the swoony romantic stories that I have seen in 800 million heterosexual couples. So as with all shows, there are certain things where you just have to agree to disagree. I want to get to another listener question. This one is coming to us from Farah.
Hi, this is Farah from New Jersey. And my question is, are we supposed to be hoping that the roses move away from Schitt's Creek? Because I want them to stay.
All right, Stephen, what do you think?
I agree with Farah. I mean, I think the show has really stacked the deck against us wanting them to leave. Every time the show has given us a glimpse into their former lives, not only are they less fully rounded people, but all the people around them that we meet are kind of terrible. And so, like, why would we want them to go back to mingling with people who like them less, who they like less, who don't understand the lives they've been living for the last few years? To me, the show makes me want them to succeed. The show makes me want them to kind of get what they want and get a happy ending, but that should not, to me, entail them leaving this wonderful little ecosystem that they've been in, because they're just more well-rounded people there.
Yeah, I also think it's possible that the answer is going to be some may stay and some may go.
Yeah.
I mean, one thing we haven't talked about that much is that the other big change in them over the course of the show, in addition to kind of coming to appreciate the people that they live around, is that they've come to appreciate each other. And so particularly, I think, with Alexis, there have been a lot of moments where she's kind of realized, oh, I really love and treasure my family. And one thing that they may have to learn is that they don't all have to live in two adjoining motel rooms to remain close to each other. So I want to hit one more listener question before we go, because I think it's a good one to end on. And I'm going to ask for a nice quick answer to this listener question from Lydia.
Hi, PCHH. This is Lydia calling from St. Louis, Missouri. My question is, please describe your favorite Moira outfit and or David sweater. And then if you could include the episode number that it's in so that we can look at how accurate your description was. Thanks. Bye.
All right, Glenn, what do you think?
In episode 5 of season 5, it's called Housewarming. Moira Rose is kind of dragooned into babysitting, or as she would say, babysitting. And she's wearing something that is just these little silver discs, just nothing but a choking hazard. And she just looks amazing because she thought she was going to go out. I also love it whenever she puts a wig on top of a wig, because sometimes wigs can be hats, hats can be wigs.
She also, all of her wigs have names, and she treats them like yep. She treats them like her dear friends. Stephen, do you have an answer to this?
I mean, I am not necessarily good at describing outfits or wigs. I do enjoy the fact that each time we seem to meet them, they're wearing a different one, which is mm-hmm. which gives you this mm-hmm. nice additional gag every time one of them enters a room. I will pivot off of this question, though, and say I want to talk about my favorite Moira Rose pronunciation, because sure. I mean, Glenn okay. mentioned Bebe, which they return mm-hmm. to repeatedly, but I really want to talk about the sleeper, which is Moira's pronunciation of the word enchiladas. Which just made me laugh so hard. And from now until the day I die, I will refer to enchiladas when discussing that.
She hits every T like it's a closing door. Mutants. And
Catherine
Alexis,
O'Hara.
Now is not the time for petty talking.
I will say, I can pick a favorite David sweater very, very easily, because not only is it a great sweater, but it is a great piece of story. We've talked about that Simply the Best performance in the Serenade. Mm-hmm. David wears black and white almost always, almost exclusively. Mm-hmm. David wears black or black and white sweaters. Even before you actually hear that the Serenade is wonderful and beautiful, it is going to help open up David as a person. When he is at this open mic event, he is in an orange and yellow and red sweater, like an explosion of fire. And it's like, once you see what happens in that scene, you're like, oh, I should have known it was going to be wonderful and transformative, because here's David dressed like a fireball, which he normally never does. So it's one of those wonderful things that costume folks and wardrobe folks do on television that I'm always so incredibly grateful for. So I think we have to call a halt to our discussion of Schitt's Creek, even though it could be an hour and a half long. Tell us what you think about it. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet us at PCHH. Thank you so much for picking that as our listener poll winner. I'm so glad you did. When we come back, it's going to be time to talk about what's making us happy this week. So come right back.
Right now, every household in the country is being asked to fill out the U.S. Census. It's the form that helps us determine how voting districts are redrawn, where to build public schools and hospitals, how to spend federal money. So why are some people afraid to fill it out? We're getting into all that this week on NPR's Code Switch podcast.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It's time for our favorite segment of this week and every week, especially now, I have to say. What's making us happy this week? Glenn Weldon, what's making you happy this week?
Keeping on the Chris Elliott tip, in 1986, he came out with a television special called Action Family, which is at least one of the weirdest things I've ever seen. It pops on and off YouTube with regularity, but if you want to read about it, a 2013 article in Vulture by Ramsey S., ESS, really captures what it's about, and here's what it's about. Chris Elliott is the leader of a cheesy sitcom family until he steps out his door, and then he enters a cheesy 70s action show with car chases and gunplay. It is some of the silliest, stupidest things I've ever seen. It is hilarious. It is pure Chris Elliott. And it ends with him and his sitcom family singing a Partridge Family song, because how else could it end? So that's Action Family in various places, including a Vulture article from 2013.
All right. Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. Steve and Thompson, what's making you happy this week?
Well, I want to talk about two sources of musical calm. One of them from NPR Music. Several of my colleagues have launched a series called Our Daily Breather, which, as the name suggests, every weekday we ask a musician or a writer to name a source of calm and comfort. And so sometimes this means using some of our great music writers, and sometimes it means asking musicians like Jason Isbell talks about the Werner Herzog and Dmitry Yasyukov documentary Happy People, A Year in the Taiga, which is a documentary about fur trappers in Siberia.
Sure.
We get Vanessa Carlson talking about how much she's been loving Liz Phair's memoir. We get Thundercat talking about anime and the importance of crying. It's a little bit like What's Making Me Happy, but it's like What's Making Me Calm. And that's every weekday at NPR Music. That's Our Daily Breather. Now, my daily breather and my source of calm for the last several weeks, I have talked before on this show about how much I love the band Clem Snide. I have been laughed at for how much I love the band Clem Snide. Clem Snide just put out its first album in 5 years. It's called Forever Just Beyond. It's produced by Scott Avett from the Avett Brothers. And if that pairing intrigues you at all, really spend some time soaking up this wonderful, wonderful record. Yves Barzelay, the singer-songwriter in Clem Snide, wrote these songs while going through a dark period in his life, and it is really pretty astounding how well this album maps over our current moment. His voice has been a source of real comfort for me for 20 years now, and this record is the best thing he's done in ages. I love it so much. It's called Forever Just Beyond by Clem Snide.
All right. Thank you very much, Steve and Thompson. What is making me happy this week is maybe just as on brand as Steven shouting out the Clem Snide record, because I want to shout out friends of the show, Kumail Nanjiani and Emily V. Gordon, the co-writers of The Big Sick. You might have seen his chest in a magazine recently. They are lovely, lovely people, funny and warm, and they are married. And she's immunocompromised, which she has talked about a lot. And so they've been quarantined a little longer and more intensely than a lot of us. And they are making a new podcast from quarantine/isolation called Staying In with Emily and Kumail. And it's really just them talking about like what they're up to, how it's going, what the stresses of isolation are for them, how they're handling it. But also just stuff like, you know, telling a story about her accidentally getting the Nintendo Switch wet at the moment that they need the Nintendo Switch the most. It's really, really funny. Their chemistry, as you would expect, is delightful and wonderful. There are two episodes plus a bonus interview episode as we tape this. Strongly recommend it. Again, Staying In with Emily and Kumail, available wherever you get your podcasts. It will do your soul good. It is calming and sweet and really funny, and I could not recommend it more highly. Before we go, we wanted to take a moment to remember the musician Adam Schlesinger. He died Wednesday from complications caused by COVID-19. Adam Schlesinger wrote or co-wrote so many great songs. We've talked about this before. Yeah, he was a member of the band Fountains of Wayne. All three of us were fans of his work. Steven, you've written a couple of pieces about him for NPR Music this week.
Yeah, Adam Schlesinger's creative legacy was absolutely remarkable. You mentioned Fountains of Wayne, five amazing albums stretching from the mid-90s into 2011. Those first three Fountains of Wayne records are just absolutely incredible. He wrote the song That Thing You Do from the movie of the same name, was nominated for an Oscar for that. That song is perfect. Gosh, he was in a bunch of other bands. He was in bands like Ivy, Tinted Windows. He was actually nominated for an EGOT. He won Emmys and a Grammy. He was nominated for Tonys and an Oscar. He worked on the Stephen Colbert Christmas album, and he wrote or co-wrote 157 songs for Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. I know that all of us on this show love that work on Crazy Ex-Girlfriend so, so much. Such an incredibly versatile and wonderful talent, and gone far, far too soon at just 52.
Yeah, that was a real heartbreaker. And I think as you wrote for NPR Music, a lot of his legacy is as a really, really wonderful collaborator. Do you have a favorite that we should play and listen to?
Yeah, I mean, when news of this was breaking, the first song so many people mentioned was Stacey's Mom, this big hit for Fountains of Wayne from 2003. But my favorite song of his is actually from that same album. It's this wonderful, wintry piece of absolute perfection. It's called Valley Winter Song. The snow is coming down on our new England town, and it's been falling all day long. What else is new? What could I do? I wrote a valley winter song to play for you.
Well, I can't argue with that pick. That brings us to the end of our show. You can find all of us on Twitter. You can find me at Linda Holmes. You can find Steven at I Dislike Steven. You can find Glenn at G.H. Weldon. You can find our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy, and our producer, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Thanks to both of you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. If you have a second, subscribe to our newsletter. It's at npr.org/popculturenewsletter. We'll see you all back here next week when we will be talking about the Netflix series, maybe you've heard of it, Tiger King. From Staten Island to the Upper West Side. Everybody keeps telling me to watch. The dog hit his head on the desk. I'm sorry. It really made me